Hello and welcome to the first episode of the sixth season of the Ubuntu podcast. It's Wednesday, the 27th of February, and in this, the first of our weekly half-hour episodes, we're going to discuss the news highlights since we've been away. We'll also be talking about the latest happenings in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Tony.
Good evening, Mark.
Alan.
Hello.
And Laura.
Hello.
Well, there we go. Yeah. It's good to be back.
It is.
Yes.
Excellent.
Have we forgotten how to do this?
It's just a bit different from normal.
Yes. Sounds like a fun packed show.
Yeah, that'll do. Now it's time for the news. And in our first article, Glyn Moody writes for The H on why it's time to stop using open source licenses. What's all
is
this
it?
About?
This is a bit of a controversial topic.
He's arguing that copyleft licenses like GPL have declined as companies no longer need the license to compel them in order to contribute code back.
So what he's saying is that companies get open source now.
That
you don't have to have a term in your license which says if you... you make changes, you have to distribute the code of those changes because people get that it's a good idea to do it. So in that case, you don't need the sort of compelling of the license.
Enforcement.
Right. Enforcement, yeah, there we go.
So the FSF can pack up and go home now.
That seems to be what he's arguing, yeah.
Well, and given he's the head of the open source, what's it called? Open thing.
Open thing?
Yes. Isn't he head of the... OSI? The people who, OSI, yeah.
It's
people
Simon Phipps.
Simon Glyn. Ignore me.
So essentially the argument is that corporations have got a conscience now.
Partly.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, what he's really saying, what he comes down to in the end is that you should just dedicate everything to the public domain, if such a thing exists, or not claim copyright over things.
Right.
Because, well, the idea of a non-copyleft open source license is basically to ensure that if people reuse your code, then they say that you wrote the original code. However, in practice, like the BSD license says that you have to do that and not a lot else. But in practice, you could just have a credit somewhere in an about screen, which no one ever sees. So that doesn't really get developers, you know, the recognition that they want. But having your code published on GitHub does that anyway, and you don't need a particular license with your code to be able to do that.
Okay.
Does this come about because companies are already using this as a way to, you know, do their open core thing where they have their open source bit and then they have their plugins on top? And because everyone's now moving to this model, or a lot of companies are moving to that model, it makes it kind of redundant?
I don't know. I think... part of the problem actually comes from the developer's point of view. There's this term that's been bandied about a bit recently called post open source software, which
post PC arena.
Post hardcore music. yeah, basically the idea being that people just publish stuff on a site like GitHub with no license attached to it, on the assumption that we don't need to bother with that license, man.
Right.
Hipsters. that's the
hipster license.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, okay, I get you.
When, you know, the idea being, oh, you know, we'll just take it and do what we want with it. There's no need to bother with licensing terms.
RMS would have a fit.
Well, yeah, the problem with that is what that actually means in practice is that they're publishing it all rights reserved and no one can use anything. So if a company if a company did say, oh, that looks really useful, we could use that in our product, then lawyers would say, no way, you can't touch that with a barge pole.
Because the thing about a license is it does define clearly and unambiguously what the terms are.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, another thing which would do that would be a public domain dedication, which is what Glyn is suggesting in his article.
And public domain has always been the most free of ways to make software or any other material available.
Yeah.
The Richard Stallman problem is that it means that people can take it and incorporate it into closed source software.
Sorry, the Richard Stallman problem. That sounds like a really bad, like,
band
70s.
In the 70s.
Yeah. No, I was thinking of a TV show with two leather chairs and a black background. Okay. Like two people sat there discussing the Richard Stallman problem.
It was the Alan Parsons project, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, but the whole point of the GPL is that people, anybody, be it a company or an individual, can't then include GPL license software in closed source binaries, make it better, but keep those changes and improvements internal.
Yeah, exactly. That's what makes free software free.
Yeah, but having everything public domain doesn't stop people doing that.
That doesn't offer the same protection, if that's how you look at it, that the GPL or the copyleft licensing like the GPL does.
My brain just keeps looping. I think Glenn Moody spent more time thinking about it.
He's dedicated most of his life to thinking about this kind of thing.
I just keep going, but what if, but does that matter? What was the point of that in the first place? Why do we do this? What's happening? It's a bowl of petunias.
Okay.
I think I'll shut down now.
Okay, well, we'll leave Glenn to the licensing.
Yeah. And what else has happened while we've been away then?
I don't know. As soon as we went off the air, bags of stuff started happening in the Ubuntu arena that, you know, somebody in this room probably knew about, but obviously wasn't able to tell us for various legal reasons.
It's just that I want to carry on being employed. That's all.
But didn't sort of say, oh, well, you might want to stay on air through January.
Look, I've been stung by giving people clues like that in the past, so I'm not going to do it again.
Keep these months free in your calendar.
So what has been going on then, Tony? Tell us.
I don't know, but that's it now until December.
Yeah. So, yeah, there'll be no more news the rest of the year. Ubuntu has announced their developer kits for Ubuntu on phones and tablets.
Yeah, so there's an SDK.
What's an SDK?
Software development kit, so developers can start writing applications for the new thing, which is the Ubuntu phone and the Ubuntu tablet, which actually is the same software, really, that runs on both. An extension to that is the same software could run on your desktop or your TV or your cloud or, you know, any device. So
so I could do apt-get install LibreOffice on my Ubuntu tablet and it would run.
You could, whether you'd want to, is another matter. But actually, you could try and it probably wouldn't run because the way the tablet's been implemented is doesn't have X. So there was a big announcement at the beginning of the year for Ubuntu Phone,
yep.
And then it was shown off at CES, and then there was another announcement just a couple of weeks back about the tablet. Yes, and then that was shown off, or is being shown off right now at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona.
Cool.
So there's three things there. There's the phone, the tablet, and the SDK.
Right. Okay. Can people buy one?
Not yet. Okay. Well, you could buy yourself a Nexus 4,
yep.
Or a Nexus 10,
yep.
Or any one of a number of other devices that the community have rallied around and ported it to. So we wrote a porting guide on the wiki that showed what you need to do to get this from our images that we've created, because we can't support every single device.
Yep.
Yeah, no. We just don't have the resources. So we've picked like the ones that we know we can create images for. So there's four devices that we've created images for. They're Nexus devices, which makes it easy for us because they're unlocked. People in the community can then take those images and the source code and, you know, whatever else they need and smush it together and put it on other devices. I think there's been like 30 people sign up with different devices.
Cool.
And they're all listed on the wiki, and there's 10 have already been done, and every day there's like new people stepping up to port it across to other devices.
So I can actually download an image for my Nexus 4 now and run Ubuntu Phone on there.
Yes.
Cool.
Do you have to wipe the existing installation?
So the instructions that we've got, you wipe it and you lose everything. You lose your Android install, you lose all of your data.
Yeah.
And it will wipe it and put it clean. Some people have been monkeying around with multi-boot systems.
That's what
and have got those working with dual boot kind of stuff so they can switch between Android and Ubuntu. We didn't test that because we were just looking at clean installs, but people in the community are writing documentation showing how to do that. So, and I've had people tweeting me saying I'm dual booting.
Cool.
So
nice.
The key thing is that this is a developer preview. It doesn't fully work.
So you won't be able to make phone calls?
Yeah, you can make phone calls.
Cool. So
that's one of the things.
So that's one up on what was it? Open Maloko.
Open
down in Acapulco.
Open
Maloko.
Open Maloko.
That's the one.
There are some tricky things like if your SIM is locked and stuff, that makes it harder. And you know, there are loads of UI things we haven't done yet.
Yeah.
So there's like placeholders for various things, but you know, we're very clear that this is a developer preview so that people can get a device and they can open Qt Creator on their Ubuntu PC and they can press a couple of buttons and squirt their code down to the phone and it run on the phone. And as you saw earlier on, we did exactly that with some code you've
And in written. Fact, yeah, I wrote a little app in QML, which is the development language for the phone environment, which is a declarative version of Qt, which has been around for a while. In fact, it was what... the Unity 2D was written in for a while, wasn't it?
It was Qt. I don't think it was QML completely. I don't know.
Okay. So, yeah, but that also lets you use some C++ in the back end if you want to do things like hardware-accelerated graphics.
So we're trying to encourage people to use pure QML.
Yeah.
Because if it's pure QML, then if you write something that's in pure QML and it runs on the phone, it'll also run on the tablet, you know, the TV, the desktop, run on all of them.
Right.
So long as the form factor adjusts appropriately for portrait landscape and big screen and all that kind of stuff. But the same code will run. You don't need to rebuild it, recompile it.
I see.
Whereas if you build a C++ app, then it's got to be built for ARM and x86 and whatever other platforms, which is why we're trying to encourage people to write QML apps if they can. But that doesn't mean we're dismissing all other languages. It just means that's the preferred way because that enables it to run everywhere. And, you know, you could run phone apps on your TV or on your desktop or on the tablet.
And, of course, it integrates with the Unity web app API as well.
Yeah.
So things like Facebook and Twitter work sort of like native apps.
Yeah, we get a big win if we support HTML5 because, you know, there's loads of people out there already doing HTML5 apps. So if we support it, then... boom, we've got a whole boatload of apps that we can use straight off the bat without having to rewrite absolutely everything.
So how does it work? How does it differ from what you would get if you're running an Ubuntu desktop?
At the moment, it's quite different because it's based on the Android kernel and we're using the Android drivers. So that makes it easy for us to support Android devices. That's why it's very easy to port across. If your device already runs Android, which Android phones do, funnily enough, then we're sat on top of that.
So, you know, the underlying stuff is compatible with the hardware.
Yeah.
And then you just put the Ubuntu stuff on top.
Yeah.
I should be an engineering manager for Chronicle.
There's some glue in the middle, and we've used some other open source tools. Like there's libhybris is one of the things that we use, which came out of Yola. For their Sailfish phone.
Okay.
Yeah. So a couple of the guys who started developing that, we've picked up some of that and we're using that and we're passing our fixes upstream to them as well.
Okay.
And that allows us to have Ubuntu sat on top of an Android kernel and as to talk through to the devices that Android talks to underneath.
Okay. So what does it look like?
Looks pretty quite
shiny.
How does it work as an interface? What do people see that's different from Unity on the desktop?
So on the desktop, it's not touch. It's not built for touch. I mean, everyone keeps saying Unity on the desktop is like it's a touch environment, and it quite plainly is because there's loads of keyboard shortcuts, and you know, it's very, and the things you hit with your finger are tiny. So it's built for touch, and one of the main changes is the swiping gestures.
Okay.
So there's no physical buttons on the device. You swipe up from the bottom to bring up menus, swipe in from the left to get to your application, swipe in from the right to switch applications, and swipe down from the top to do indicators. And that's actually similar to the desktop. So the launcher's on the left and the indicator's at the top. You know, there's some similarities, but we've gone a bit further for touch.
Okay. So will there be integration between the Ubuntu desktop and Ubuntu running on mobile devices?
Eventually,
yeah,
they'll all look similar,
right?
And there will be uniformity across them. At the moment, they're not. You know, the one that's built on the phone is built on QML, and the one in the desktop is built on Compiz.
Mm. Isn't there this idea though that you could take your Ubuntu phone, you could dock it into a tablet, and then you could run mobile apps and tablet apps side by side? And then you can attach a screen and keyboard and use it like a desktop.
So the convergence story.
That's it, convergence story. There we go, yes.
Yeah, exactly that. You can take a phone, attach it to a piece of bigger glass, you've got a tablet, attach it to a screen and a keyboard and it's a PC, attach it to a 50-inch TV and it becomes a TV interface. Cool. And Unity should detect those different environments and be able to intelligently decide, well, there's a keyboard and mouse present and I'm plugged into a 23-inch screen, therefore I'm probably being a desktop now.
Yeah.
Whereas when it detects all those things go away, then chances are it's been unplugged from the dock and it's now been put in a pocket, so it should be a phone mode. Mm. So Unity should be multi-personality across all those devices, and that's the ultimate goal. But like I say, it's not there yet, but that's the aspiration.
Where does it leave Ubuntu for Android?
Well, so
in the dust.
No, not at all. Actually, Ubuntu for Android is just a separate project,
right?
And that still exists, and I expect that will come to market at some point this year.
Oh, okay.
And you'd be able to run an Android experience on your phone.
Yeah.
And then when you dock it, you get the Ubuntu experience.
Not that I want to try running LibreOffice on my phone, but is it necessary for people to redevelop their apps in the new languages and new frameworks that we were talking about? So if you've got a desktop app like LibreOffice, do you have to rewrite it for mobile?
Do you really want to run LibreOffice on a phone?
It's
seriously
an example.
Okay, yeah. For example, if you have an app which currently works, is not written in QML, it runs, it's an ex-Windows app.
It's an app in the software center.
Is there a way of getting it without redeveloping it onto a tablet?
Not currently.
Right. Okay.
It might be that in the future there are emulation layers that allow simple X apps to run on the phone.
Okay.
That's not ideal, though.
No.
Be good if you could just recompile automatically.
Yeah, that would be lovely.
Yeah. the trouble is, what do you recompile? Because just getting the code to run doesn't get an interface that works.
Plus,
a lot of stuff on the desktop is dependent upon stuff like GTK, which isn't on the phone. So, you know, you're going to have to write either new apps or, you know, rebuild your apps or strip your apps down in some way. But people have already started doing that. We've already got a library of apps where people in the community have started writing, you know, new apps for the phone.
Cool.
And we're being approached by, you know, other people who have their existing apps who want to write those new components that make it work on our phone.
I think it's fair to say there's a lot of excitement and interest in our IRC channel about Ubuntu on phones at the moment.
Oh, crikey.
And I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about it during the coming year. A couple of other news stories that caught our eye while we've been off the air. One has been a dispute over the name Python.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is a bit sad, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It couldn't come to an amicable end. What actually happened?
Well, a friend of the show, Simon Phipps, has been reporting on this for some time. Basically, there was a company who registered the domain Python, I think python.co.uk, here in the UK a long time ago and didn't really use it for anything, and occasionally use it to sell an email service and things, but essentially wasn't marketing it.
Yeah, most time it just redirected to one of their other domains anyway.
Yeah, and then they tried to trademark the term Python in any sort of computing sense. Yeah.
So they're a hosting company. They started up a product called Python Cloud, which is not it's just it's a cloud service. It's not anything to do with the Python language.
Yeah, right.
They just had that brand name that they wanted to use.
Yeah,
so they tried to trademark that, which would of course cause problems for anybody trying to use or trying to market essentially the Python programming language.
Yeah.
So that's not very friendly. And the Python programming language, I believe, predates their registration of the domain anyway.
I think so, yes.
And people in the community got a bit stroppy about it from the sounds of things, which obviously then upset people.
Basically, if someone applies for a trademark, then you can, you know, people can object to it and say, you know, these people shouldn't have rights over that name because, you know, that it could be a cause for confusion with this product with a similar name or whatever.
It's the prior art argument.
It does highlight how, you know, if I out of the blue said the word Python, you'd all know that I was talking about the programming language.
Mm.
For people outside this room and outside our bubble, they might think you're talking about Snake or they might think you're talking about Monty Python.
Yeah.
Yes. You know,
that'd be the other thing I'd think of.
Yeah. and you know, for these people who work in the IT industry, you doing something that you would expect them to know about this stuff, but they don't.
Particularly as a hosting company.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems odd that they'd be allowed to trademark it.
Well, this is why the community backlash happened, because the Python Software Foundation said we need people to object to this to show the Intellectual Property Office that this name means something else to a lot of people. So it's like if somebody tried to I don't know, trademark Mars, and people said, oh, but I think of Mars as chocolate, and you're trying to...
But that's fine, as long as it's not in the same domain.
Yes, but okay. Yeah, for example,
say someone...
If you're
trying to do another chocolate bar that was Mars, that would be a problem.
Sorry, yes. And they said, I think of Mars as that caramelly thing, not your nutty
but
thing.
But as you say, the Python's all in the computing domain. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
So Opera is switching to WebKit instead of their existing engine, which is called Presto.
I believe so. Yes. Then that's closed source, and WebKit's open source, which is good.
Yay.
WebKit is already used for Safari, I believe.
Safari, and Chrome,
Android browser, so this iPhone browser.
Lots of other things. So this makes life easier for web developers. They only have to develop for WebKit or not.
Firefox uses Gecko.
Sorry, if they develop for WebKit, it is compatible across all the browsers using WebKit.
Ah, yes.
Is that the case?
Yeah, but you shouldn't do that. You should develop for standards, not for the things that WebKit is implementing.
Except for IE.
If you test in Safari using WebKit, it will be compatible. It will work with all other WebKit browsers.
As long as you've followed standards, not followed WebKit special shims and stuff.
Right.
Which the worry is that people will now say, oh, pretty much everything's WebKit, so everything that WebKit has implemented I'll use, and not bother with making sure that things work everywhere else. Kind of like they did with IE6, where they said, oh, everyone uses IE6, so I'll make a page which uses certain things that work in IE, but not in everything else.
And they came to regret it.
Yes.
Mm. So what else uses WebKit?
Everything
that's not Firefox and IE that's a web browser now.
Chrome?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Chrome, Safari, Conqueror.
Dillo.
Oh, there's one or two. There's one or two odd little ones that use Gecko and don't have a rendering engine and things like that. But yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Cool.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I think that probably is all we've got time for to round up the news on this episode and everything we've missed in the last month and a half.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If there's something you think we should talk about or someone we should talk to, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content. And that can only mean one thing. More quizzes.
And we're back. You might remember... as if you weren't sure. You might remember we used to have a segment called Bit About Ubuntu. We've rebranded it to Community News, Including Events.
Gerald. So this is formerly known as, Gerald, formerly known as the Ecosphere.
Yeah.
It's going really well. Okay, so the same stack of things that happened in the Ubuntu community. We're not going to try and recap everything over the last 2 or 3 months. But the first thing that caught my eye was a potential redesign for Totem, the movie player that's in Ubuntu, of its user interface. And it was rather nice. Unfortunately, the screenshot that I looked at has disappeared from the internet.
What's changed?
It's all shiny. It looked like it could fit in well with something like Unity, where there's lots of translucency in the UI.
Is this a proposed design from a community person or something?
I got the impression it was just somebody in the community mocked it up. It looked very nice with the idea of the toolbar that appears over a playing movie being sort of translucent. So you can still click on it and interact with it, but you can see what's going on
it's
in the background.
It's less intrusive.
Yeah.
So Totem has had an update recently, the version that's in Raring. They removed something that I don't know what it is about the known developers who decide to remove stuff, but they've removed the file open dialogue.
That's pointless, isn't it? That one?
Nobody needs that. But I guess I'm supposed to double click on videos rather than open the video player and then go file open. Or I go to the playlist and then hit the plus button and go and find a video.
Or
and then
use
add
your
it
file manager and drag it in.
Or something.
So you've got lots of options.
Yeah, I have, but not the one option that I used to use.
Well, Control O, does that still work?
Yes.
So it's literally just a menu item that's gone.
Well, as a Unity user, we know you're a very big fan of keyboard shortcuts.
No, it's all touch. I've been poking the screen, and it's just not working.
He's been poking the screen on his non-touch screen laptop.
Yes, exactly.
Mashing it with his fist.
Yes.
Okay, but yes, a shame it disappeared because it looked really sweet and it might come to pass
yet. So that's a mission for the community, is go and find that screenshot.
Yeah. What's next?
So the Ubuntu Developer Summits, which were every 6 months, and
at the start of every release cycle, was it?
Yeah.
At
the end for the next one.
Start, yes.
And they'd ship a whole bunch of developers across to meet everybody in person. Now they're going to be every 3 months, but virtual.
Yes. And shorter.
Yes.
And shorter. Well, not a week.
Yeah, they're only lasting 2 days. Well,
the last one was 4 days. In person. And yes. This, what is it now? 2 days.
2 days. Every 3 months.
So I guess this just a cost-cutting exercise for Canonical?
So, austerity bites!
So do you know, the last UDS was in Copenhagen.
Right.
And we had to hire the biggest convention centre in Scandinavia to get everyone in.
Wow. Okay.
It's grown to a lot. So it costs a fair bit of money to do it.
And I suppose, becoming increasingly a logistical nightmare as Canonical and the community both grow.
So there's that I'm sure plays a part.
Yeah.
But also, leading up to phone and tablet, is no secret that we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And having one UDS, the next one isn't actually for another, 2 months? Beginning of May.
Your schedules don't line up, do they?
And then another one in October. You know, we need to get going on this stuff and make decisions like now about the stuff that's going to happen in the desktop and the phone and the tablet and server. We've got to start making decisions, and to do that, we all need to get together a lot quicker and leaner and more often.
There is a potential downside, though, which is that
there are a few.
But one of the things people have always said about UDS is that it's great to meet in face to face and have a beer and hang out with people, and it helps carry you through the next 6 months worth of development using just text and Google Hangouts and stuff. It really helps get the human interaction going.
Yeah, but between previous UDSs, like we're talking 6 to 8 months ago and beyond backwards, we didn't have Hangouts. And we've used Hangouts a lot as a company internally. We use them all the time. Almost all of our company meetings are...
This is Google Hangouts, not just some cool guys on the street corner.
Google Hangouts. So there's like up to 10 people with their webcams on having a discussion. So you get FaceTime. Okay, it's not exactly the same as, being in the same room as people and going out for beer in the evening and, playing cards, or even the corridor conversations that you get at UDS.
Yeah.
You're missing out on those. But, we've got to make some sacrifices for the next year to get this stuff done. And, we can't just look back with fondness and say how, great previous UDSs were. We've got to look forward and get stuff done.
Interesting times, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's next, Mark?
Hack and Talk, Laura Tchaikovsky's event, which is a technology-related bar camp in London.
Yes, it's on Saturday the 9th of March from 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. And you can basically go along and hang out.
And talk.
Yes. Yeah.
So you need to book a ticket. We'll put the link in the show notes. Hack and Talk, Eventbrite thing. Just go there and get a ticket.
And it's at Google's London campus, so if you've not checked that out before, it's a good opportunity to have a poke around.
Yeah, she's got some nice bit of space. They've got a huge canteen area, and Laura's managed to get that space for Hack and Talk.
Cool.
Should be good fun.
I saw that on MasterChef, in fact. They cooked there.
Really? Did they?
Yes.
I don't think they'll be doing that at the same time.
Okay.
What's next?
We've got a blog post which details the new daily builds of the Ubuntu phone and tablet images. So we put out a developer preview, and now we're doing daily images, and there's a lovely little tool called Phablet Flash. And you just run Phablet Flash minus L to get the latest, or Phablet Flash minus B to do a bootstrap of a clean device with your Android device, your supported Android device plugged in, your Nexus 4, Nexus 7, Nexus 10 or whatever. And it will just download the image and blat it over the top. It's brilliant. Cool. It's really good. It's good to keep up to date with the images.
Nice.
Brilliant. There's a couple of events to tell you about as well. One is the Northeast GNU Linux Fest, which is happening on March the 16th and 17th at Harvard University. So that's northeast of the USA.
Not Newcastle.
Not Newcastle.
Oh, yeah. That is really northeast, isn't it? And finally, Open Source Junction, which is an event being run by... me at work and the rest of my team, which is taking place on the 14th and 15th of March. That's in a couple of weeks at Trinity College in Oxford. And it's free. And it's on the subject of open source hardware meets open source software. So if you're interested in hardware hacking and open source hardware and that kind of stuff, then it should be interesting. We've got some really cool speakers lined up. If you go to osj4.eventbrite.co.uk, you can get a ticket and see what's going on. And it should be awesome.
That sounds awesome.
That's all for this episode. Join us next time where we'll be interviewing Elizabeth Krumbach and going over your feedback and having some gooey love.
We should explain.
Not as bad as it sounds.
We will explain.
No, we won't.
It hopefully
doesn't
we
have to be now.
It is a new segment.
Yes.
Listeners, calm down.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our first shorter format episode.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time.